From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dr. Abraham Verghese constantly has to point out that when it comes to technology, he's no Luddite. Verghese is an acclaimed writer and physician who teaches medicine at Stanford, but for the past few years he's been promoting an old-school technique in medicine, the power of the human hand, which he calls the most important innovation to come in the next 10 years. Verghese worries that in an era of computer imaging, the patient in the bed, the physical body, is being replaced by the image of the patient on a screen. Dr. Verghese is in Utah this week, here to give a lecture at the University of Utah, and he's joining us to talk about the importance of the physical exam in medicine, not just as a technique, but as a ritual he calls transformative and at the heart of the physician-patient relationship. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the doctors who still do them, the physical exam of a patient takes on a kind of routine, taking the pulse, pulling down the eyelid, tapping on the chest, listening to the heart. Dr. Abraham Verghese calls this process a ritual, a crucial part of the relationship between the physician and the patient, but he worries it's falling by the wayside, seen as a redundant process in an era when computer imaging can look deep into a body. Verghese has called the power of the human hand one of the most important innovations in medicine in the next 10 years. And he says the physical exam is more than just a diagnostic tool. It's transformative. It recenters the attention in medicine away from images and back to the body. Dr. Verghese says it's as important to the doctor as it is to the patient. Abraham Verghese is in Utah this week, here to give the Tanner Humanities Lecture at the University of Utah, and he's joining us today to talk about the power of touch. We invite you to join the conversation, if you like, with questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Abraham Verghese is a writer, a physician, a professor at Stanford University School of Medicine. Among his books is the novel Cutting for Stone, which came out in 2009. He's also contributed an essay to the book Writer MD, which was just published last month. And Abraham Verghese, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to begin with, I guess, one of the things that you've talked about in the past, and this seems really important to this idea of the ritual in the exam, and that is the first time a doctor encounters a patient. And you've talked about doing your own rounds that you make with medical students. And you said that each week when you go on the rounds with a new group, you ask them this. You say you don't want them to tell you or the other students what the patient's diagnosis is just yet, that you want to see how much the body will reveal alone. Talk about what you're getting at there and how important that first encounter is with the patient.
I should just qualify that by saying I don't do that with all my rounds.
Sure, sure.
This is a special rounds that I do with my students at Stanford on Wednesday afternoons. But I've actually done it for the last 20 years wherever I've been.
Huh.
And I ask them to introduce me to their patients. And I say, don't tell me or the other students what your patient has, not so that we can be clever and make a diagnosis in the absence of that, but because it's amazing how the moment you have a label, you stop looking. You're already sort of conditioned by that label. And very often students will say things like, well, my patient has no physical findings, which is never true. But even if it were, there's so much that one can go over just in terms of the normal exam. But what I get at with that introduction to them is to say, let's avoid labels and you'll be astounded as to how much we'll pick up. And frankly, very often we do pick up the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And it leaves the students with a memorable impression, not of me, but of this art that we've been doing for 100 years or more, and which in the hurry-burry of, you know, labels being slapped on in the emergency room, even before you see the patient, people stop looking and they don't actually believe that one can do this.
So is it true these days in some ways that a doctor may see an image of a patient before they see the patient itself?
It's very true. I think it happens all the time where the emergency room works up the patient, calls up and says you have an admission, and the house staff quickly get on the computer and they've already seen the image and they go down there with lots of preconceived notions. And I actually feel sorry for our house staff in some ways because they're missing the chance to sort of see the patient evolve from the outset. And more we're trying to find ways to have the emergency room let us know at the outset so that we can be part of the evolving process, not just receive them with the label slapped on. And the challenge for me as the attending physician is very often I see the patient the next morning and there have been all these labels applied and they're usually quite correct. But my job is to make sure that the patient was listened to and that we didn't prematurely slap on a label when in fact there's something else going on.
You've talked about the importance of the master and the student, the teacher conveying the importance of this ritual to students. And I wanted to find out who conveyed it to you. Do you remember how the ritual was sort of brought to you as a student?
Yeah, it's very much a time-honored ritual. It's not as though, I must say, Doug, it's not as though I've invented something that I'm promulgating. I mean, this is the way medicine has been taught for several hundred years now, where one learns by example, one learns by modeling the behavior of the master. And, you know, we talk about crafts like luthiery or cabinet making. It's very much the same where you are apprenticed. You watch carefully how the master does something. And it's the kind of thing that cannot be taught by iPad or on a web module. You have to sort of be taught one-on-one. Your hand has to be guided. You pick up the special terminology of the craft. You model, unfortunately, you model good and bad behavior. If your physician master is one who doesn't carry any instruments and you know, is more wedded to technology, that's what you're going to pick up.
Yeah.
So I was taught in the 70s and 80s by physicians both in India and Africa who were very much part of that school. And it was also an era when we didn't have all the technology. So it made us, you know, really reliant on the bedside exam in order to judiciously order the few tests that we could order. I think what has happened in America, you know, which has actually been to our detriment in many ways, both economically and otherwise, is that we have what one of my colleagues, Alan Garber, who is a physician economist, now he's the provost of Harvard, he called it the menu without prices, you know, where it's like filet mignon every night. You can order anything you want on any patient. I actually never stopped to think, what's this going to cost? If I need a test, I order it. And it's a luxury we have. But the downside of that luxury is we've become quite habituated to ordering tests willy-nilly, and only in the last few years are we becoming more worried, as we should be, about the radiation costs, the radiation exposure, the actual physical costs. But, you know, in the healthcare economy the way it is, no one seems to know who's paying, and no one is paying directly, so we just order away.
You've talked a bit about the history of this ritual, which is time-honored, as you say, but sort of new as an innovation, I guess, in some ways. And there's a terrific story that you've talked about, Joseph Auenbrugger, an innkeeper's son who discovered percussion.
Yeah.
Talk about that, if you would, because that seems like a really important turning point.
I'd be happy
point.
To. Yeah, it's interesting that all those years before about the mid-1800s, no matter what ailed you, if you went to a modern Western physician who was often a barber surgeon, this person would bleed you, cup you, purge you. It didn't matter what the particular complaint you had. And they would also pull your teeth and cut your hair long in the shorts, you know, long in the sides, short at the back, whatever you wanted. There was no attempt made at an anatomical diagnosis. And Auenbrugger was the son of an innkeeper. And one of his memories was his father going down to the basement of the inn and tapping on the sides of casks of wine to determine how much wine was left and whether to reorder. And Auenbrugger, when he became a physician, began to apply this to the body and began to tap on the chest and the abdomen. And it's interesting that everything we know about percussion, which is what this is called, Auenbrugger developed and published in that one book of his called Inventum Novum. And it was a huge moment in medicine. It was a moment that would be the equivalent of the discovery of ultrasound, a way of looking inside. And it was followed very closely by Lennox discovering the stethoscope. So within the space of about 20 years, all of a sudden there were these ways of looking into the body. In fact, the moment people began to carry stethoscopes, which were wooden cones in their pockets, they were signaling something to the general public. They were signaling that they were no longer the barber surgeons who were empirically bleeding or purging or cupping, but they were committed to trying to make distinct diagnoses. And Lennox, for example, was one of the first to come to the realization that if you had a cavity in the lung from tuberculosis and if you had a swelling in the spine, so the so-called POTS abscess, these could both be the same process manifesting in different ways, you know. And it was the dawn of a very, very exciting era in clinical medicine, culminating in about the 1900s, 1930s, where clinicians were incredibly astute at the bedside in recognizing what was going on and correlating that with autopsies. And you would think, Doug, that now we would be 100 times better than they were at the bedside, because we have so many ways to instantly confirm these things. But in a funny way, we're 100 times worse. We have simply lost those skills. And again, I don't advocate those skills to stand alone.
Right.
But I think those are great skills to use to order judiciously the right tests and spare people unnecessary testing.
How do you describe someone who does it well? What is the gift? Is it a kind of sensitivity in the fingers, a kind of touch that they know what they're feeling for? How do you describe it?
Actually, I think first I should say that many, many people do this exceedingly well.
Yeah.
But increasingly, I think we've failed to teach a younger generation how to do it well. And it isn't really witchcraft or anything like that. It's actually time-honored ways that people are taught to percuss the chest, listen to the chest, look for signs of disease. But I think what has happened in the hurry-burry of modern medical practice, as we have the hospitalist movement emerge, there's been so much emphasis on, you know, throughput, bringing the patient in, getting them out, so much emphasis on process that the time it takes to teach this stuff has suffered. But when you do it well, it encompasses everything from the moment the patient walks in the room, noticing that their dress is inappropriate for the season. When you shake their hand, noticing that their hands are sweaty and warm and it's quite cold outside. And then you automatically, your glance goes up to their eyes and you find that their eyes are staring and you begin to wonder, do they have thyroid disease? So there are these, you know, hundreds of little inferences one makes along the way, even before the patient has even sat down. And then as they disrobe and you examine them more thoroughly, even more things that you pick up. And, you know, these allow you to say, well, you know, given your story and given what I'm finding, I think the money is in our getting this test. And I find that people, my colleagues who do this well, tend to be about a day and a half ahead of people who don't do it well and who have to order tests willy-nilly and hope the answer falls out of the sky. But I think what's more concerning to me is we've collected anecdotes in the study that we're doing of soliciting physicians to tell us anecdotes where people overlook something simple that had consequences. And we've you know, collected about 250 anecdotes from all over the country. And 70% of the time, what went wrong was that someone overlooked something obvious, which then made the patient be subjected to a diagnostic test and contrast and radiation, or sometimes a surgical procedure that could have been completely obviated had they simply practiced what we've all been taught to practice, but which is slipping away.
The idea of touch, you've talked about that, and you've told a story I wanted to ask you about. A good friend of yours who had breast cancer, who had gone to this state-of-the-art facility, and was treated fine, of course, because they had all of the technology. But the thing that she felt suspicious about or didn't know what to make of is the fact, as she told you, they didn't touch my breasts.
Yeah, she was very reluctant to tell me why, after all these efforts she'd made to go to the best center in the world, why suddenly months later she would be getting her treatment with her local oncologist in our town. And when I pressed her, it turned out that the place was efficient, it was welcoming, it was integrated, it had all the systems-based things that we like to talk about these days. But she said, you know, they didn't examine my breast or didn't do it very well. It felt very cursory. Now, you and I could argue that they didn't need to examine her breast in the sense that they had her scanned and they had her tissue typed and they knew her breast cancer down to the molecular marker level. And the human hand's ability to pick up anything in the breast compared to what they had done was trivial. But to her, it mattered greatly. To her, it signaled a kind of inattentiveness that she could not abide. And so she returned to her local oncologist, who every single time she went to see him would examine both breasts and examine the tail of the breast and the armpit, and did it in such a thorough manner that to her that ritual spoke something about spoke of a general attentiveness, which I think is terribly important. That story was a revelation to me. It suggested to me that even when there isn't much to be revealed in the exam, there's an important transaction taking place. I mean, if you think about it, the fact that someone would come to another person, tell them things they wouldn't tell their rabbi or their preacher, and then incredibly disrobe and allow touch, which in any other context would be assault. When someone does that, your skills in examining them and your attentiveness to that gift that they're offering you has to be worthy of what they're offering you. And patients pick up very quickly when you shortchange that opportunity, when you stick your stethoscope on top of the gown, or where you do a half-assed prod of the belly and move on. William Osler, a great American physician, said many years ago, patients will judge us not by the diplomas on the wall, but by the manner and grace with which we examine them. I think that's very true today even.
So it seems like beyond it being a process, I mean, ritual is an important word in the symbolic sense of the term, I suppose. And you've described it as transformative, like all kinds of rituals. I wanted you to talk about that, if you will.
I must say that I don't think I saw this as a ritual till I talked to my anthropology colleagues. And I was telling them about the magic how with certain difficult patients who'd come in with chips on their shoulders and ready for you to be in the long line of people who disappoint them. Right. For example, chronic fatigue patients who I've had, a series of them. I realized that the thorough examination was doing something. I remember this one very voluble patient who had finished telling me the long story, and then I began the exam. And I have a routine when I examine. I always begin by taking the blood pressure myself, and then I pick up the hand and I look at the hand for certain things like Dupuytren's contracture and clubbing, and then I slide my finger down to the pulse, and then I'm into my ritual, I'm into my routine. And this very voluble patient quieted down, and I remember with her having this very eerie sense at one point that the patient and I had slipped back into a primitive ritual of sorts in which I had a role and the patient had a role. And when I was done, the patient said with some awe, "I've never been examined this way before," which if it were true is a real condemnation of our healthcare system, because so many people had seen the patient. And then when the patient dressed and sat down in my office, I wound up telling the patient precisely what she'd heard at Scott and White or Mayo or any other place she'd been, which is, "This is not in your head, this is real." And then I would trot out all the recommendations we make for chronic fatigue. And I always felt that if the patient gave up the quest for the magic doctor, the magic test, the magic treatment, and embarked with me on a course towards wellness, it was because I had earned the right for them to tell me this by virtue of the exam, that some important transaction had taken place in the exam. And even if you have all the information you need without examining the patient and you jump straight to the x-ray to get your answer, you would have missed a tremendous opportunity. And that transformation, I think, is such an integral part of a ritual. I mean, all rituals are about transformation. We marry to signal a transition from being single to being, with someone else. We baptize to signal an entry into a special world. Similarly, I think this has all the trappings of a ritual, and the transformation, as I see it, is the sealing of the patient-physician bond. It's some important thing that happens that you can't shortchange no matter what technology offers you. And that's what I have come to really believe strongly, and find that patients resonate with that message very easily, as do my students. It's the constraints of time and technology that limit us.
Well, speaking of the constraints, I mean, you've talked about, I'm not sure if you do this all the time, but certainly with chronic fatigue patients, you've talked about there were moments when you would just go into the initial sort of conversation with them and just listen to them. I think you said, for 45 minutes, not do anything other than just hear and not interrupt, which is remarkable. I think you've said that physicians are interrupt within 14 seconds? I think there's some sort of statistic there.
There is a statistic that we interrupt our patients within 14 seconds, indeed. I must say I can't do that for every single patient, but I realized with the chronic fatigue patients that there was no way to do them justice in a 45-minute new patient visit. So I would actually give them the entire first visit to tell me their story without interrupting them. And that itself is therapeutic. I mean, if you think about it, so much of our experience of illness is something that we want to convey to the physician. And very often I'm sitting there and a patient is telling me something and I already know the ending. I already know what the whole story means. But the older I get, the more I realize how important it is for me to allow them to finish their narrative. Because in the telling is an equally important catharsis that takes place, a sense of, okay, now they listened. Mm-hmm. Then when you examine them, I think what you're doing when you examine them is you're now taking the locus of that story and applying it to their soma. You're sort of confirming the personhood by localizing what they're talking about on their body. It's a very important step. Even if we didn't need any of these things, I think these are important steps for the patient to feel that they were listened to. I had the opportunity to talk to medical students this morning, and I was telling them that cure alone isn't enough, that you're also in the business of healing and curing. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds hokey, so if I can just use the analogy that I used with them, I said to them, imagine leaving this class where we're seated now, and imagine you went home and found that someone had kicked open your door. Your lock is in splinters. All your belongings are strewn around. Your valuables, your cash, your computer have been taken away. Your iPod, God forbid, has been stolen. You'd be devastated. Not just a loss of stuff, but a sense of spiritual violation. And I said, imagine now that the police come by and they come by in a few hours and say, we caught the person who did this. Here's all your stuff back. Well, at that point, you're cured, but you're not healed. Your sense of violation might be so strong that you would move to another apartment building. So I think all illness has those two elements. There's a sense of physical loss, but there's always a sense of why me, why now? And I think the wonderful thing about the tradition of the physical exam, the necessity for it, is listening to the story, examining the patient, quite apart from anything else, is a way of bringing about the healing. Mm. It's an important step, and you can't shortchange it.
There's an image I wanted to ask you about, a painting that you've talked about, written about, in fact, by Sir Luke Fildes. And I guess to you it conveys the importance of the way a doctor is perceived.
Yeah, it's a remarkable painting. It's perhaps the most famous painting in medicine, the most iconic painting, The Doctor by Luke Fildes, and it's at the Tate Gallery. In fact, it was commissioned by Tate as he was building this collection. And Luke Fildes was commissioned to paint a painting of social importance. And he chose to depict the scene of his son, Philip, who died on Christmas Eve, I think it was 1890 or so. And he chose to depict the physician in our time. And it's a haunting painting, which I think possibly we can put up on your website.
It's on our website. We'll put it on our website right now, in fact.
Where you see the image of this child in the center of the room lying on a couple of chairs that have been pulled together. On one side is the physician, on the other side the parents. And the physician is remarkable for his singular attentiveness to the patient. And there's been so much interpretation about this painting and what does it mean. And I've always thought that everybody got it wrong. It's really not about the doctor, despite the title. It's really about us, the viewer, projecting ourselves onto the patient and thinking to ourselves, this is the kind of attentiveness and attention I want if I'm ill. You know, and I've often wondered if Luke Fildes was commissioned in this day and age to depict the physician in our time. I wonder if the place where that child is would instead now be occupied by a big computer monitor. Because in many ways, I think that's what's happened symbolically is, the locus of our attention has become the computer. There's been a study recently that in a 10-hour day of a hospitalist, 4 hours are spent on the computer. And none of us want to spend all our time there, but that's become the locus of attention. I've actually coined a term for this entity in the computer. I call it the eye patient, you know, like your iPod and your iPhone. The eye patient is getting wonderful attention all across the country. And the real patient in the bed wonders, where is everyone? When are they going to show up? Who's going to explain what's going on? I think it's that disconnect that worries me. And I think ritual is a very important way to bring the two together. And that's very much what I hope to talk about tonight at the Tanner Lecture.
Writer and physician Abraham Verghese, he's the author of the novel Cutting for Stone. He's giving the Tanner Lecture on Human Values tonight at the University of Utah. There's a link to the Tanner Humanities Center on our website. And at the end of next week, they'll be posting a video of the event. I mentioned, Dr. Verghese anyway, mentioned the painting. We'll put a photo of that actually on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer and physician Abraham Verghese is joining us. He's in Utah this week, here to give the Tanner Humanities Lecture at the University of Utah. Dr. Verghese has been thinking a lot lately about the bedside evaluation that a physician gives to a patient, the way they talk to and touch them. He describes it as having a powerful therapeutic but also a symbolic value. Dr. Verghese is giving the Tanner Lecture on Human Values at the University of Utah. Tickets for the event are sold out, I mentioned, but I should also say that unclaimed will call tickets will be available 5 minutes before the event, which begins at 7 o'clock, and we'll give you the more details about that as we go along. Dr. Verghese, I wanted to ask you about, you've written about something that happened to you about at the age of 50. You'd been a physician since 24. You've written about this, and you had a kind of it was almost like you had a crisis of faith, I think, in some ways, about medicine. And you've written about the fact that you woke up to find yourself really uncertain about the validity of what you had been teaching. And it came from this visit you took to India. And I wanted you to talk about that moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I had gone back to my parents' land, Kerala, the south of India, where they were born. I was not born there. I was born in Africa. But it's a land I know well from going on vacations with them every summer. And I went to visit a colliery, which is an ancient institution of martial arts. And it's where we think a monk took martial arts from there to China and so on. But unlike other dojos, for example, the institutions in Kerala are also very wrapped up in treating injuries and chronic injuries and rheumatic conditions and doing massage with special oils they believe in and Ayurveda and so on. And I went for a massage, which is a popular thing for people to do. And it's a very unusual kind of massage. I was in a special room on a teak platform on a floor. And the therapist, a male, holds onto a rope from the ceiling and balancing with that, with the hard sole of his foot, does a massage that is really sort of a thumping, sweeping, very unusual massage. And then has you sit up and puts the sole of his foot in one of your joints and leverages you. I mean, it was the most unusual sort of massage. And When I was done with it, I remember having this extraordinary sense of, wow, I mean, all the years I've spent in medicine, do I handle the body with the same ease and skill? And I was also left with this tremendous sense of gratitude towards him, you know, a sort of a something that in psychiatry they would call transference. In fact, in psychiatry, they make a big thing out of transference. You analyze the feelings the patient develops for the therapist over time, which is probably related to the feelings they develop with the world and conditioned by their parents and so on. But in my case, it was a much more immediate sensation of gratitude and awe about this person who had taught me something about my body. And I've sort of taken that notion back with me and been using that to reflect on my interactions with patients and, you know, what does the exam do for the patient? What does it do for me? And I've had, you know, more than a few times where patients feel a real sense of wonder at the exam. And I can tell that if they had a veneer of resistance, that I've cracked it simply by virtue of the exam. But what it does for me, I think, is it allows me to sort of, A, make some very simple diagnoses and sort of understand what's really going on with this individual, where the locus of the problem is. Sometimes you find that the cyst that everybody's worried about on the CAT scan is not where they're hurting, and they're hurting, you know, 10 inches below that, and it's completely unrelated. These are things you can only find from the exam, and it's very, very satisfying. But I think what I'm much more intrigued by as time goes on is the quality of privilege that you're given to touch. Very few people in this world are given that privilege of touching someone when they're ill for a diagnostic purpose. But as Eric Kessel writes in one of his books on illness, he says there's a, quote, tenderness there that's so important. We're given this privilege, and in doing it with skill and with a certain grace, there's also sort of a tenderness that you're conveying back to the patient, especially in chronic illness. And I have some people with chronic illnesses that I see. I examine them every single time because I recognize to them it's important, and I recognize that to me it's important. There's an important transaction there that I don't want to have missed. And I remember one anecdote, if I may, of a sure. patient who was dying of AIDS, and on the last day of his death, I remember he was just skin and bones at that point. And I remember every time I'd come to see him, I'd remember that out of my sense of hopelessness and not knowing what else to do, this is the era before we had therapy, I would always examine the patient. And I remember, you know, I'd have my routine, pull down their eyelids, look at the tongue, percuss the chest, listen to the chest, feel the abdomen, look at the limbs. And, you know, I did this all the time. And on the day that turned out to be the last day of his life, I remember that he was barely breathing. And I came to see him. His mother was there. And his eyes, which were half open, sort of registered that I was there. And I saw his hands begin to move. And I couldn't figure out what he was going to do. And to my amazement, he was reaching for his pajama buttons to unbutton his pajama so that I could examine him. And it was, you know, it was such a tender moment for me, and I immediately obliged. But I recognized that in examining him, I was conveying something. Something of importance to him.
A bond.
And to me.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, you know, it's interesting.
If I could add, I think what I was conveying was the notion you convey by examining them every time that I will always be there. I will never let you down.
Yeah.
I'm going to show up and I'm going to do this thing and I'll take you through this journey. That's it.
That's the point.
That's the point.
It's interesting, the emotion that you're conveying now. I think you were talking about that experience you had in India where after that that massage, you felt a sense of emotion there as well. And there's a moment I want you to read, if you don't mind, if you're of a mind to do it, from your book, Cutting for Stone, which to me conveyed the sense of that familiarity and intimacy. It's a moment early on in the book, of course, and this is the English surgeon, Dr. Stone, and the woman who would become his wife when she first – he's very ill, and she first examines his body. Is there some way to set this up?
This is an ocean voyage where Sister Mary Joseph Praise, the nun, is traveling, and so is Dr. Thomas Stone, a surgeon. They don't really know each other, except she knows he's a physician. And there's this shipboard fever that's broken out, and people are quite seriously ill, including one of the other nuns. And Sister Mary Joseph Praise goes to Dr. Stone to try and have him come help, but finds him very, very ill, not from the fever, but from a bad seasickness. And so this describes, you know, sort of a strange moment where the nurse, she's a nurse and a nun,
yeah,
is examining a physician, so to speak, or trying to take care of him. There was so much that she did not know about medicine. In the middle of that ocean, surrounded by the sick, she felt the weight of her ignorance. But she knew how to nurse, and she knew how to pray. And so praying, she eased off his shirt, which was stiff with bile and spit, and she slid down his shorts. As she gave him a bed bath, she was self-conscious, for she had never ministered to a white man, or to a doctor for that matter. His skin displayed a wave of goosebumps at the touch of her cloth. But the skin was free of the rash she'd seen on the four passengers and the one cabin boy who had come down with fever. The sinewy muscles of his arms bunched together fiercely at his shoulder. Only now did she notice that his left chest was smaller than his right. The hollow above his collarbone on the left could have held a half cup of water, while that on the right only a teaspoon. And just beyond and below his left nipple, extending into his armpit, she saw a deep depression. The skin over this crater was shiny and puckered. She touched there and gasped as her fingers fell in, not meeting bony resistance. Indeed, it appeared as if two or perhaps three adjacent ribs were missing. Within that depression, his heart tapped firmly against her fingers with only a thin layer of hide intervening. When she pulled her fingers away, she could see the thrust of his ventricle against his skin. The fine, translucent coat of hair on his chest and abdomen looked as if it had drifted up from the mother lode of hair at his pubis. She dispassionately cleaned his uncircumcised member, then flopped it to one side and attended to the wrinkled and helpless-looking sack beneath. She washed his feet and cried while she did, thinking inevitably of her sweet Lord and his last earthly night with his disciples.
I love that moment and that sort of the moment of emotion there that conveyed that sense of intimacy and the familiarity and what she's getting with that touch. To me, I guess that came from your own kind of examinations. It seems
it harks back, I think, to that sense of parallel, if you like, between Christ washing the disciples' feet. I remember a very famous professor at Southwestern University in Texas. I think his name was Gene Wilson, who, as famous as he was, as full of honors and accomplishments as he was, you would find him every Thursday in the diabetic clinic cutting the nails of some of his patients with diabetes because their vision was too bad and their sensation too bad. And, you know, there was a sort of a humility and a sense of ministry, which I think is getting lost sometimes in our emphasis on science. You know, this was always art and science, Doug. Medicine was never science alone. And I think there's a term that describes medicine, which is the ministry of healing. And I like that term, ministry, because I think that most of our medical students come to medicine with a great sense of ministry, a sense of calling, a sense of wanting to serve. And something about the way we train them, something about the system, something about the way we practice in our medical industrial complexes can tend to rob them of the very kind of honorable service that they came in wanting to provide. The good news is I think most of us come back to some version of this as time goes on, but it's not what we're taught.
Dr. Abraham Verghese is with us. He's giving the Tanner Lecture on Human Values tonight at the University of Utah. Tickets, as I mentioned, are sold out, but unclaimed will call tickets can be available 5 minutes before the event, which starts at 7 o'clock at Kingsbury Hall. There's a link to the Tanner Humanities Center on our website, and at the end of next week, they'll be posting a video of the event. You can visit us for that and for an image of the painting we talked about earlier on our website, kuer.org/Radio West. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with writer and physician Abraham Verghese. He's in Utah this week, here to give the Tanner Humanities Lecture at the University of Utah. We'll give you details about that, by the way, as we go along. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wanted to ask you, how is the medical community reacting to all of this? Some see a physical exam as, you know, fine, as helpful. Some see it as redundant. You're constantly having to say, look, let me remind you, I'm not a Luddite. So I mean, how are people reacting to all of this?
I think the medical community is reacting very well to it. I think, you know, there's a sense from all of us that we've sort of lost control to some degree, that our time is being managed not by us but by reimbursement schemes and payment systems. You know, it's quite ironic. I feel especially bad for our medical students. I mean, they come in so full of idealism and they become quickly aware of, you know, so much of what we do is governed by where the money is. You know, I always like to point out to them, you've seen short-stay surgery centers, you've seen freestanding birthing centers, you've seen freestanding oncology centers, cardiac centers. You ever seen a freestanding geriatric center? You ever seen a freestanding, you know, primary care center? There's no money in those things. And so you don't find the, you know, valet parking and all that around a geriatric center. And I think so much of what we're doing is driven by the economics of healthcare that we're sort of in opposition with a system that's completely haywire. And I'm hoping that in my lifetime we can see it change and get fixed, because it's getting quite out of control. But most physicians, I believe, subscribe very much to the notion that I'm describing. I don't want to in any way suggest that what I'm suggesting is unique or what I'm doing is unique. I think I'm giving words to a sense that a lot of physicians, particularly physicians my age and older, another generation, have, that, you know, no one's really paying attention, that we're getting too caught up in the technology, the image, and we're forgetting the patient. Mm. At Stanford Hospital, you know, I see a lot of very, very complicated patients, as they do here, I'm sure. You know, their second liver transplant, and now they have a fungal brain abscess, and they have resistance to this. And, you know, there must be at times easily 30 different physicians from 10 different teams coming to see the patient, you know, dialysis, this and that. And it's amazing to me how often a patient or family will say, I'd like to see that doctor again. I want to ask him something. And they'll be trying to find my name and can't remember. It has a lot of syllables in it. And they'll see the person who examined me pretty well. That's the person I want to go see. I want him to come back. And all they remember is that I did a 3 or 4 minute very quick exam. And it makes me realize that we're not all doing that. We're often going by the numbers in the chart or going by the recent x-ray, popping in to say hello. But the exam has lost some of its ritual meaning, which I think it's important to bring back.
You know, one thing you've written about is that this ritual involves words, the way that a doctor translates what's happening to the patient, or even the way the teacher translates that to the student. Mm-hmm. That terms and words, mm-hmm, and the way they're this is an important part of the ritual as well.
Yeah, I think it's a very important part of it, and I think that what I hope to talk about tonight is, because of technology, there's one more step that is a great opportunity to bring those images back to the patient. I recall when I was practicing in Texas, I was in El Paso, and most of my patients there didn't speak English. They were Spanish-speaking only. My Spanish is good but not great. And I could always tell there was something missing in translation, which had I spoke Spanish better, I might have conveyed. And I remember seeing a patient who came in with a big liver abscess, and the abscess was huge, and we did all the appropriate treatment, and he was getting better by all the numbers. Mm. His fever was down, his white count was down, but every time I went to see him, I felt that he still looked apprehensive and concerned, and he wasn't looking as well as his images suggested he should look. And I took a guess that the problem was that he wasn't understanding what was going on very well. So I went down to radiology, brought the images back up, and I showed him, you know, this is your liver, you know, in Spanish, and this is the abscess. This is it 7 days later. It's much smaller. And it was a tremendous epiphany for him. And it was also an epiphany for me, a sense of, wait a minute, these images belong to the patients. And we are missing a step of bringing the images back full circle to them, you know, and saying, I've examined you, and this is what the machines have showed us. Now let's superimpose these two things and take you through what we have. I mean, I think we do that nominally, but it might well be that in this era of technology, that the last step in the exam might be, come, let's stand in front of this mirror, and I'm now going to project your echocardiogram, your CAT scan, your MRI. Mm. Let me walk you through this body, because after all, you own it, and I want you to walk away feeling not disembodied, which is the usual way you feel after you go to a physician, but feeling embodied, better than well, perhaps, because you have a deeper insight into who you are.
When we talked before, we talked about the difference between being a writer and a physician, and you don't really disconnect those two gifts in many ways. You've talked about that, and I wonder. It seems to me the gift, a big part of it, and which relates, I think, to the exam, is this idea of observing. The power of observation. There's a great story you've told before about Dr. Joseph Bell, who is, of course, the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes. Arthur Conan Doyle used one of the inspirations anyway. This power of observation that seems something that you need as a writer as well as a physician.
Yeah, I think actually medical training is a wonderful training to be a writer. You know, because you do learn to observe closely, or at one time we were taught that, it's, as I said, it's fading. Yeah. But you do learn to sort of take disparate clues and tie them together into a whole. So it is a valuable training. But I do resist the notion of wearing two hats. I think people want to make me into a physician and a writer and ask me which I like better. And I completely resist that. I see myself as all physician. I've been given this great privilege of, you know, entering into people's lives at their most vulnerable moment. I hear things that no one else in the world gets to hear. And I never walk into the hospital without a sense of great awe. And I never leave without a great sense of privilege that, you know, I'm walking out. I'm leaving people in there who won't walk out. And, you know, it's a tremendous honor. And I think I write out of that stance, even when I'm writing fiction, even if it's completely unrelated to medicine. And by the way, I don't think anything can be unrelated to medicine. I mean,
really?
Know, we're all, I mean, after all, we're all going to die. We're all mortal, you know. We might spend a lot of time forgetting that fact, but it's really what makes things poignant. I think it was Wallace Stevens, the poet, who said that a rose, if roses didn't wither and die, if they just stayed beautiful all the time, they wouldn't be roses. They'd be weeds. They'd be all over the place, you know. And I think it's the poignancy of life that I think makes medicine relevant to all life. And I feel very much that I'm a physician, I'm an observer, and I am definitely writing about the things that move me, but they come from this wellspring of the great adventure of being in medicine.
You don't have to reveal too much about what you may be writing, but are you working on novels and things too?
Actually, I am, yeah. The reason I went to India is because I've just been in awe of how well my first novel was received. I mean, it's still on the New York Times bestseller list. It's 108 weeks, but who's counting? And it has been due to many different things that it's been successful. I think the book clubs, the wonderful book clubs who've embraced the book, but also I think the exotic nature of the backdrop. I really think that I succeeded in making geography into a character. So I'm working on a novel set in India, where my parents are from, another land that's exotic, but which I know well, which has a lot of history. So the next novel is very much to be set in Kerala.
Really?
Yes.
Do you have time? Do you take time to write every day? Or, I mean, where do you find the time?
Well, I write when I can. Stanford has been just incredibly accommodating. I mean, all these years at different medical schools, I wrote by stealing time from, you know, my weekends, my nights, my family. Stanford was the first university to offer me the opportunity to have protected time. So when other people disappear to their labs to do their research, my research equivalent is I disappear to a second office that I have to write. And I don't have a phone there. It has somebody else's name on the door. No one knows where it is. I can show you, Doug, but I'd have to kill you after that. So I get to write some there, but I also, weekends and nights is when I get a lot of writing done.
Let me ask you finally about what you're hearing from students. You've talked about the fact that you need to transfer this from this idea of the physical exam from being a chore into a ritual. What's the how do you teach it, I guess, and what how do you convey that, the importance of it being something more than just a diagnostic tool?
Well, I think the lovely thing about being at Stanford is we've been able to really I've been using the bully pulpit of being at Stanford to sort of bring new energy to this thing which has interested me all my life. And so we've started something called the Stanford 25, which is a way of, you know, emphasizing the technique and how important it is by going over 25 different maneuvers that are particularly prone to be done poorly because of technique. And that has caught on. I mean, I had a medical school in Baltimore, famous medical school, I won't mention which one, call up and say, Abraham, this is a lovely idea, the Stanford 25. Can we borrow it? And I said, help yourself. It's only been around for 100 years or so. I mean, all I'm doing is bringing this back to the forefront. So if your listeners are curious, if you type in the word Stanford 25 and my last name, this site will come up with, you know, so I think more and more there's a sense that as healthcare reform comes, if we find that we have to cut back on technology, we can't order tests willy-nilly, there'll be a lot of premium placed on the bedside exam, and patients want it, and students love it. So I think it's really win-win all around. My sense is that we are turning a corner, and we're going to come back to a new sense of reverence and appreciation for the importance of the exam at many, many levels, and that we can't cure and heal without that being part of our armamentarium.
So this is kind of the, I think you put it this way at some point, the critical juncture.
It is very much critical juncture. And in many ways, the dysfunction of healthcare is playing right into our hands, because the reason healthcare costs $3 trillion, a large part of it is because we're ordering tests willy-nilly. I mean, I joke, but I only half joke, that if you come into my hospital missing a leg, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, and orthopedic consult. And we have to reverse that trend. It's cost-effective. It's good medicine. What's more, patients love it. We love it. It's important to do.
Abraham Verghese, the writer, physician, professor at Stanford University. His novel, of course, is called Cutting for Stone. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's delivering the Tanner Lecture on Human Values at the University of Utah's Kingsbury Hall. The event is free. Tickets are sold out, but unclaimed tickets in the will call area will be made available 5 minutes before the event begins. Dr. Verghese, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.